Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of what the real question should be in regards to what happened in Benghazi on September the 11th last year, as opposed to the trumped-up partisan circus that has been largely generated by Fox News since then. A former CIA veteran, Melvin Goodman, the author of National Insecurity, The Cost of American Militarism, joins us to discuss the facts behind the fiction, as outlined in his article at Counterpunch, The Real Benghazi Scandal. Then we'll examine the issues raised about women's health and breast cancer treatment that have followed actress Angelina Jolie's New York Times op-ed, where she reveals she undertook a prophylactic double mastectomy to avoid a genetic likelihood she would contract the disease that kills close to 40,000 women in America every year. Dr. Susan Wood, a former FDA Commissioner for Women's Health and Executive Director of the Jacobs Institute of Women's Health at George Washington University's School of Public Health and Health Services, joins us to discuss the connection between breast cancer surgery and breast implants. Then finally, we will discuss the radical shift underway as the U.S. changes from the world's leading importer of oil to a net exporter, overtaking Russia as the world's biggest gas producer by 2015. One of the most quoted analysts on energy issues, Fadel Gait, Senior Vice President for Oil and Gas Research at Oppenheimer & Company, joins us to explain the reshaping of the world's energy markets and the shift in the global power balance outlined in a new report by the International Energy Agency. And joining us now is Melvin Goodman, who is a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy and a professor of government at Johns Hopkins University. His 42-year government career included service at the CIA, State Department, Defense Department, and the United States Army. And his books include Failure of Intelligence, The Decline and Fall of the CIA, National Insecurity, The Cost of American Militarism. And his latest article at counterpunch.org is The Real Benghazi Scandal. Welcome to Background Briefing, Melvin Goodman.
Thank you, Ian. Good to be with you again.
And clearly this Benghazi story has been largely inflated by Fox News over the months, and then it looks as if the Republicans were able to breathe some life into it with these recent hearings where the deputy chief of mission spoke. And then, of course, ABC News got hold of these memos from the National Security Council about sanitizing the talking points for Susan Rice's appearance on the Sunday talk shows shortly after the incident that took place, of course, on 9/11. So far, they haven't needed any evidence to make all these assertions that this is the new Watergate. It's more like Whitewater than Watergate, isn't it?
Well, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean that someone isn't watching you, and just because Republicans are raising these issues doesn't mean that there aren't issues that should be raised, but they're not raising the right issues. They're fighting a political battle against Obama now and Hillary Clinton for 2016. But there are issues that should concern particularly the Senate Intelligence Committee and the chairman of that committee, because on the first hand, you had the CIA writing briefing notes or briefing points, some call them talking points, that were then vetted by the White House and the State Department. Now, the CIA is charged with serving two masters. That's been true ever since the Church Committee hearings in the 1970s. They have to serve the White House, and they have to serve the Congress, Capitol Hill, and the new intelligence committees that were created in the 1970s in the wake of the Church Committee hearings. And for the State Department and the White House to be vetting that intelligence and making changes, obviously for political reasons, the White House to lower the terrorist threat and the State Department to lower their culpability in terms of the security failure in Libya. So the Intelligence Committee should be worried about that, and the Intelligence Committee should be worried about the fact that they weren't properly briefed on Benghazi. Benghazi wasn't really a consulate. It was an intelligence presence. When the plane flew out that night with the people who had survived the terrorist attacks, there were 30 people on the plane, 23 were CIA, and 7 were State Department. There was no reason for a State Department consulate in Benghazi. You didn't have that kind of American business travel to Benghazi, and you didn't have American tourism in Benghazi. And for the ambassador to be going there on the anniversary of 9/11 without proper security really didn't make a lot of sense. And then finally, Obama has so weakened the inspector general process in Washington, particularly the statutory inspector general at the CIA, that it's going to be very hard to find out what really happened and what the CIA role was in providing proper security for their personnel who were in Benghazi, some on a very sensitive and important mission to buy back weapons we had been providing to Gaddafi over the years that were now getting into the hands of rebels and militants. So there are some key issues And maybe when the Republicans stop playing politics with this in a bipartisan way, we can look at some important things.
But is there any light being shed on why the ambassador went there in the first place, given that the entire country is unstable? And, you know, after 40 years of or 50 years of one dictator, you know, obviously there is a political vacuum there. And you've got these Mad Max groups running, driving around in pickups with heavy machine guns, etc. And on the very day of 9/11, he goes there ostensibly to open a book fair. I mean, what in God's name is that a priority, a book fair to be open on 9/11?
The sources I've talked to in the State Department said that Hillary Clinton was planning to go to Libya in December. She wanted to go to Tripoli, and while she was there in Tripoli, she wanted to announce an upgrading of the consulate in Benghazi, which, one, I don't think was a very good idea, and two, wasn't proper use of her time. But that Stevens' mission to Benghazi was to try to acquire ground truth on what the situation was like in Benghazi before Hillary Clinton made that trip, even though I don't think she was planning to go to Benghazi. So I think there was that purpose. But for Ambassador Stevens, who was very knowledgeable about the Middle East, was a linguist, an Arabist, knew Libya, was very popular in Libya, I think he was totally lax about his own personal security, traveling there with a very modest sort of protection from State Department security, which I don't think is that strong to begin with, and with the CIA relying too much on Libyan militias for CIA security. And then you have the Congress. Here you have Republicans complaining about the security situation, and they were the very people who voted down additional appropriations to provide security in these very difficult spots where we're throwing Americans into harm's way. So here I think there's been terrible neglect at all levels of the government. And we have this incredible tragedy on the anniversary of 9/11 when we should have been most vigilant. That was an obvious day for a strike of this type, and all the people on the ground knew it had nothing to do with any spontaneous activity and it had nothing to do with a YouTube video that insulted Islam. People on the ground knew right away what it was, but because we were in the election season and only 2 months away from the election, the White House clearly wanted to play it down as a possible terrorist attack. So that's how you got the emphasis by Ambassador Susan Rice on this spontaneous activity, which everyone thought was laughable who knew anything about Libya.
Well, obviously, as I mentioned, the hearings with the DCM, who was somewhat critical, although the previous report by Thomas Pickering and the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Admiral Mullen, was much more scathing in general. That's been seized on. And, of course, ABC News getting hold of this chain of emails from Ben Rhodes at the National Security Council. That has reignited the whole story and somewhat vindicated Fox News beating the drum over these months and the Republicans trying to make an issue out of this. But then it turns out that the emails themselves are somewhat in dispute, whether ABC News really did have the scoop that they claimed and CNN of saying that they've got a different version of these emails. So what's your understanding of what...
Well, the bottom line is there was a lot of vetting done of the original talking points, and the emails will help to explain that. But it's clearly obvious that the State Department wanted to lower its culpability in these briefing notes that were going to go to the Hill, and the White House wanted to put on a more benign explanation for what happened on the night of 9/11. So the document was clearly politicized. And that should be unacceptable to the Senate Intelligence Committee because they have a right to see intelligence with the bark on. That is part of the mandate, unless it's an extremely sensitive matter, which this wasn't. There are no sources that could have been compromised, no methods that could have been compromised, even though the intelligence czar, General Clapper, claims that's why the changes were made, to protect sources and methods. Well, he's talking nonsense. I think everyone knew immediately the group that was possibly responsible, and it didn't take sources and methods to determine that. Also, I think another thing I found laughable about all this was the testimony of the DCM, Hicks. I think it was responsible of him to be trying to get some military response to what happened in Benghazi, and there he ran into a roadblock. But I think it was laughable for him to think that if the Air Force flew some F-16s over Benghazi, these terrorists would pull up their skirts and get out of there. He has a very cartoonish interpretation or image of what military power can do in dealing with insurgents on the ground. The fact is, we weren't prepared on the ground. You have an African command that's based in Germany, an Air Force presence that's based in Italy, and an inadequate presence in Tripoli, and the DCM wisely was, I think, overruled in making sure those security people weren't sent to Benghazi too quickly, because there could have been a threat to the embassy in Tripoli as well. I think whoever made that assumption made the right call. So we were unprepared. I think it was tragic in that innocent people were killed because of the lack of strategic thinking at CIA or the State Department or among Hill committees that deal with government aid and security assistance for the State Department and other institutions overseas. So I think there's a lot of blame to go around, but we've got to get past this political phase and the politicking that's going on to find out what really happened and what can we do to prevent this from happening again.
And again, I'm speaking with Melvin Goodman, who's a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy and a professor of government at Johns Hopkins University. His 42-year government career included service at the CIA, State Department, Defense Department, and in the United States Army. And his latest book is National Insecurity, The Cost of American Militarism. And his latest article at counterpunch.org is The Real Benghazi Scandal. Now, I did speak to a former deputy director of INR, the State Department Intelligence, who also was an analyst on Libya. And he was troubled by some of the testimony from Greg Hicks, the deputy chief of mission. And I don't know whether Hicks is a Republican or not, but he certainly helped that committee. And apropos what you just said about bringing the F-16s in, of course, you know, one, if you flew them overhead, they wouldn't scare anybody. And two, if you dropped bombs, you'd kill a whole bunch of innocent civilians, which would create an even bigger problem. But the other thing that Hicks said that the Republicans seized on and that the press parroted out was that there was this team in Washington that was supposed to come in to rescue them. Well, apparently that team is a forensic team. They come in after the event, and it was completely bogus. But why the Democrats on that committee didn't speak up, that's the part of it that I find extraordinary.
Well, I found I listened or watched the entire hearing. The Democrats were poorly prepared to even practice damage limitation, or maybe they were hesitant to practice damage limitation, and the Republicans just ran wild with all sorts of irresponsible comments about what was done and what wasn't done. You know, the fact of the matter is, in a situation like that in Benghazi, where the consulate is not really a consulate, it's an intelligence platform, you have the CIA as an open target if they can't protect their status as a clandestine organization. Now, if all of these insurgents and all of these militant groups knew where the CIA offices were, where their safe houses were, where the annexes were, and they probably knew individually who exactly were the CIA people, and there were 23 CIA people on the flight that went out that night as compared to only 7 State Department officers, this was an overwhelming CIA presence whose activity was well known to all of these militant groups. And even in terms of security, the CIA was so poorly prepared in terms of security that those officers on the ground in Benghazi, their first calls went to Libyan militia groups who that were sent to the consulate building to try to protect the situation. Those people ran away as soon as they encountered some fire from the insurgents group. So it was a mess on the ground. But to put Americans in harm's way without giving proper security is unacceptable, and it reminds me of Lebanon when we sent Marines in 1982, and over 200 Marines were killed from bombing incidents, and we found out later that the Marines didn't even have proper rules of engagement from the Pentagon and the White House.
And had no ammunition in their guns.
And no operating instructions for under what terms could they fire back to begin with.
Right, but at the actual bombing site, the sentries didn't even have ammunition in the guns.
No, it was a sort of a Swiss Guard type presence that you get at the Vatican.
So my understanding, I've spoken to the former CIA officer Bob Baer, who's talked to a lot of people involved in the Libyan Benghazi incident, is that, first of all, there were only about 23 bullet holes in the annex building where the ambassador died, and it's quite possible that they didn't even know that he was there. that the real attack was on the CIA building, and the fact that they could sight a mortar so accurately that killed the two former SEALs would indicate, as you pointed out, that they knew where this building was. So what about, you know, we've got this farce coming out of Moscow now with this guy that they just caught. Is the agency just not on the ball? Is that what's going on here?
Well, I wrote a book in 2008, The Failure of Intelligence, The Decline and Fall of the CIA, and I have a section of that book on the decline of tradecraft. And I talk mainly about intelligence, tradecraft, and analytical tradecraft, but I also talked about operational tradecraft. And a year after that book appeared, remember the suicide bombing at the most sensitive CIA facility in eastern Afghanistan, Khoust, where 9 CIA officers and contractors were killed, and the tradecraft was just abysmal. You had a woman there who was the base chief who had no experience for what she was doing. She allowed a suicide bomber to come on and base instead of dealing with this contact at a safe house where there would have only been one or two agency employees. Instead, he was allowed to meet the entire leadership right there out in the open before they went into any building, and they were all targeted, and nine were killed. And then if you look at the handling of the Nigerian underwear bomber later in that year, again, the tradecraft was abysmal. Remember the situation of involving 24 CIA officers in Italy and all the trials that ensued in the wake of that, and the laughable tradecraft of these people. So I don't know how far Bob Baer was willing to go, but I'd say there's been a tremendous derogation of tradecraft capability among the clandestine services. But that's the overall decline of the CIA that we're seeing, decline in strategic intelligence, decline in intelligence analysis, decline in national intelligence estimates, the need for contractors to review in intelligence products. Tremendous amounts of money are given to contractors just to review and analyze what the CIA produces and to provide adult leadership. And then if you look at Obama's appointments, Leon Panetta, who was not up to the job, a very tired bureaucrat, then a four-star general, David Petraeus, who fortunately sort of fired himself with his own behavior, giving adultery a bad name in the process, and now John Brennan, who is the orchestrator of the drone campaign, which has been increased exponentially since Bush used the drone campaign in a very limited way in Pakistan. Now we're seeing hundreds of drone flights and thousands of deaths and a lot of these innocent deaths. So things are clearly out of control. And frankly, if you look at Washington now with what's happening in the Department of Justice and the AP scandal, if you look at the IRS and what's happening with their inspection of certain right-wing political groups, indeed they were political activists, they weren't social welfare groups, but here's the IRS sort of concentrating on one part of the political spectrum. Then you have this buffoon in Moscow who gives espionage a bad name by going out with fright wigs and letters that amount to contracts with aspiring agents or possible agents traveling with a compass and a map. You know, unless he was set up for all of this, and a lot of this stuff was placed on him. I noticed his phone was on the table in the picture, and I magnified the picture, and it was a clamshell phone. It wasn't even a smartphone. You know, so what's happening to the CIA? This is the gang that couldn't shoot straight.
Well, Mel Goodman, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian. Good to be with you.
Again, I've been speaking with Melvin Goodman, who's a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy and a professor of government at Johns Hopkins University. His 42-year government career included service at the CIA, State Department, Defense Department, and the United States Army. And his books include Failure of Intelligence, The Decline and Fall of the CIA, and his latest, National Insecurity, The Cost of American Militarism. He also has an article at counterpunch.org, The Real Benghazi Scandal. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with a women's health specialist about breast cancer.
That's all my heart can say.
Good luck, good health, God bless you.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. Susan Wood, a former FDA Assistant Commissioner for Women's Health. She's an Associate Professor of Health Policy and of Environmental and Occupational Health and the Executive Director of the Jacobs Institute of Women's Health at George Washington University School of Public Health and Health Services. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Susan Wood.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
And the op-ed that the actress Angelina Jolie wrote in the New York Times this week caused quite a storm of interest in women's health issues, particularly when they pertain to breast cancer. Of course, back in 1974, First Lady Betty Ford spoke openly about her mastectomy. And I guess Angelina Jolie's op-ed is even lifting the curtain further on this. Is that, how does it strike you?
Well, I think it's telling us a story of how, you know, things about breast cancer have changed and how they've stayed the same. I think the fear of breast cancer is something that women do fear, whether it's something they heard about from their mothers, you know, and the women like Betty Ford bringing breast cancer sort of out from behind the curtain and acknowledging that it's something that is a very common cancer in women. One out of eight women will have breast cancer in their lifetime. But we've also come a very long way in that breast cancer is now can be detected, and if detected early, can be treated, and if treated early, can lead to a much prolonged life and cure for many women, while it still takes many women's lives at the same time. And we also know a lot more about the different kinds of breast cancer, not as much as we need to know to truly get at it, but the fact that for a small group of women, there's a very high genetic risk, and it's very important to realize that it's a small group of women, but if you have that very high genetic risk, then the chances of getting breast cancer are quite high, up to 85% chance that you'll get breast cancer in your life, as opposed to, you know, 1 in 8, about 12% of your chance of getting breast cancer through the course of your life. So those women have to take special steps, and that's what Angelina Jolie did in making a decision about how to address that risk in her life.
And the mutation that she was screened for, that she has, is called BRCA1, and there's another one called BRCA2, and they're estimated to cause 5 to 10% of breast cancers and 10% to 15% of ovarian cancers. Mm-hmm. So, and then in her case, she said, wrote in her New York Times article about her double mastectomy, Angelina Jolie wrote that her chances were up to 87%, which I guess is why she went ahead and did it. It's got to be an
right,
awfully...
Right, I think those numbers, what we're saying is 5 to 10% of all the breast cancers across the entire population are related to that gene. But if you have those genes, your individual risk can be 85, 87% in your life that you will likely get it. And that was what she was facing and when she thought about whether or not to have this surgery.
So given how expensive the screening to find out whether you have this mutation, BRCA, what's the medical advice on that? If it's, even if you have it, your chances vary, right?
Well, if you have it, you have a very high chance of breast cancer, but your chance of having it is quite low. So what you need, what doctors look at and what medical experts look at is whether you are at high risk for having a genetic risk of breast cancer as opposed to having the sort of overall background risk that all women face. And that depends on your family history. So for women who are not Ashkenazi Jewish, which has an increased risk of this cancer, of this genetic breast cancer, you need to have two first-degree relatives. So your mother, your daughter, or a sister diagnosed with breast cancer, one of whom younger than age 50. So, and then there's a series of others of ways to look at the pattern of breast cancer in your immediate family to see if it looks like it's something you inherited, through their genes as opposed to caused by something else. And there's lots of ideas about what causes breast cancer, but no real firm. It's not as much knowledge as we'd like to know as to what causes it. But for the women, where it looks like it's something you inherited, it'll show up in your family. And that's where either someone will have already been diagnosed as having this genetic mutation in their cells, or you have this very strong family history. And if you're not one of those women, then you're not going to be recommended to have the screening test. If you are one of those women and it's recommended that you have this screening test, it's likely that your health insurance would cover it.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Susan Wood, who's a former FDA commissioner for women's health. She's also a professor of health policy and of environmental and occupational health and the executive director of the Jacobs Institute of Women's Health at George Washington University School of Public Health and Health Services. So, but having mastectomies as opposed to lumpectomies, that was something of a controversy up until recently, and I think there was a book written about it called The Breast Cancer Wars by a medical historian, and it, apparently a lot of women had mastectomies. Some of them had double mastectomies because they didn't want to have one breast different from another, and then it turned out that more recent research indicated that was unnecessary and that lumpectomies in combination with radiation was more effective. So where do we stand on that? Because as you know, there's a certain cynicism out there that people have about the medical profession and that
right.
a lot of doctors make money out of surgeries and a lot of people have unnecessary surgeries. So
That's true. And I think we've been learning about women who get breast cancer, and these are not women like, you know, Ms. Jolie, who had this genetic risk, and therefore she does not have breast cancer, just a very high risk of it. Women who have breast cancer, it has been shown that more localized surgery, the lumpectomy, just taking the tumor and the tissue around the tumor out, and then with radiation and sometimes with chemotherapy as well, that they have just as good of outcomes as if they'd had a mastectomy. And so over the years, the evidence has shown that having a full mastectomy is not necessary for many women, and it depends on the cancer and its location and that sort of thing. But for many women, a lumpectomy, which is not going to be as dramatic, both a surgery but also dramatic impact on your breast, is just as effective in essentially limiting the breast cancer now and treating that breast cancer. But for someone at without breast cancer yet, but at very high risk, some women decide to have mastectomy because you don't know where that cancer is going to show up in the breast tissue. And so the prophylactic mastectomy, doing it in advance, is to try and prevent cancer from showing up wherever it might show up. And you have no lump to take out, so everything goes out. Now, there are alternative treatments of hormonal treatments, being very watchful and trying to catch any cancer very early should it show up. But we do have to remember that the women who go through prophylactic mastectomy, they may never have gotten breast cancer. So they're making a decision, but it's not because they know they're going to get breast cancer. They're at high risk of it, and they've decided, rather than live with that fear and that risk hanging over them, to go through the surgery. And that's a choice women can make, but some of them would never have gotten cancer at all.
Well, that's an awfully tough choice, isn't it?
It is. You know, to make that decision and to go public about it, helps more women talk about decisions about mastectomy, because you then follow up with, what do you do next? Do you go through a reconstruction surgery, which are quite major surgeries in and of themselves? And do you have breast implants, which will break in, say, 10 or 15 years and therefore need further surgeries and which don't have good cosmetic outcomes multiple times over one's lifetime, if like Ms. Jolie, you do it young. So there are lots of decisions to be made and thought through, and women's priorities and about how to handle the risk, what to do after the surgery, you know, to make sure you have the knowledge about the risks that come with breast implants. All of these things require a lot of information, a lot of thought, and figuring out what your priorities are.
Well, Dr. Susan Wood, again, the professor of health policy and of environmental occupational health and the executive director of the Jacobs Institute of Women's Health at George Washington University School of Public Health and Health Services. Just to deal with cosmetic surgery and breast implants, that, of course, has been a longstanding controversy, hasn't it? And initially, I think it started out with some of the women that were victims of Hiroshima. I think they were the first to get breast implants, and I think it became popular in the occupation of Japan because American GIs liked bigger breasts and Japanese women and therefore accommodated them by having silicone, you know, injected directly into their breasts.
Turned out
to be a catastrophe. So there's a very grim history, is there not, of breast implants and augmentation?
Yes, there's a, and there's, I mean, certainly with breast cancer patients, trying to reconstruct their breasts is certainly very an understandable desire. But whether, for whatever reason, implants are put in, there are risks that come with them. They are not well studied, although many medical devices are not well studied at all. So that's to put that in perspective. But breast implants, they will break over time, and most women, I think, enter into them either in the case of a crisis like breast cancer or for cosmetic purposes, not thinking 20 years out. And when they break, the silicone can migrate around the body, causing various problems, and they are fully recommended to be removed upon breakage, whether they're full of saline, which is sort of like salt water fill, or whether they're full of silicone, which is more jello-like. When they rupture, and they will, that silicone can migrate around. The FDA and the medical profession recommends that they be removed and replaced, but oftentimes that surgery isn't recognized or isn't treated properly, and there will be complications down the line. There are also shorter-term complications of infection and scar tissue forming, which can be quite painful, which are more immediate to the surgery. But these longer-term breakage issues in terms of the product and the problems it will create for women down the line are often not recognized.
Well, surely, Dr. Susan Wood, since I'm sure a lot of audience are hearing this for the first time, I don't believe or don't expect or suspect that this kind of information about the dangers involved in breast augmentation are particularly advertised, and particularly out here in Hollywood where women have...
No, they're not. there is good information in a booklet presented by the Food and Drug Administration. With the new products that have been removed, FDA has required companies to do long-term studies, but unfortunately the studies are not being maintained and women are being, as they say, lost to follow-up and not being followed over time to see what the outcomes are. So there is information out there, but most women don't know it, and they may not be as likely to get it from their plastic surgeon as they might get it from another doctor or from, you know, if they go looking for that information from reputable sources like the Food and Drug Administration. But, you know, these are is information that is important for women to have, that, you know, women can make their own decisions about what they feel is important, but you need to have the information about the fact that they will rupture and they will need to be replaced over time, and they should be monitored by every 2 years having an MRI, because mammograms don't work as well with breasts that have implants in them. So there's an ongoing issues with breast implants that women need to be aware of before they have the surgery, but unfortunately, as you said, they often don't get that, or they push that information aside while they're dealing with a crisis of cancer or just not thinking forward into the future.
Well, it would seem to me, though, that the difference between the situation that Angelina Jolie went through this prophylactic preventative double mastectomy, which was clearly a difficult choice for anybody to make, let alone a movie star, you know. So that seems to me to be a far cry from the vanity of wanting to have bigger breasts or your boyfriend wanting you to have bigger breasts. I mean, to me,
I think it's important to realize that, you know, women have implants for, you know, very serious reasons or for less serious reasons, and certainly maintaining your body image is important for many women, and one could say certainly for movie stars, at least in this era that we live in. But I know some women, certainly when they face cancer, they think they just want it to be over. They want the cancer away. They want the risk away. And that I very much understand in terms of wanting to end the fear and to not have to live with it every day. But unfortunately, the multiple surgeries, you know, the reconstruction surgery brings a temporary closure, but it is not, it will not be over. There will be, in years to come, consequences that are addressed by women who have reconstruction or who have implants for augmentation purposes.
Well, just in closing, to finish up on this subject, Dr. Susan Wood, you mentioned that if a young woman has breast implants for reasons of vanity as opposed to, you know, prophylactic mastectomies because of a gene mutation that causes cancer, we've established that there's a world of difference between these two things. But if you have breast implants, you said that it makes it more difficult to be screened for mammograms. Is there a higher risk then of getting breast cancer if you have implants?
I don't know if it's there are some higher risks for some specific types of cancers that are very start as low risk and get higher with breast implants. But what you have a higher risk of is missing a cancer because the breast implant itself blocks the mammogram from effectively seeing into the tissue and seeing any small cancer. So if you have breast implants, you are recommended to have very special kinds of mammograms, different angles, different types, or even to have MRIs or sonograms because the traditional mammogram won't get a clear picture and may miss cancers in the breast. It's also associated with some. If the silicone migrates out of the body, out of the breast capsule, it can is associated with some other increased risk of other kinds of cancers as well.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Dr. Susan Wood.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Susan Wood, who's a former FDA Commissioner for Women's Health. She is a professor of health policy and of environmental and occupational health, and the executive director of the Jacobs Institute of Women's Health at George Washington University School of Public Health and Health Services. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back talking about the radical change in American energy use, where the U.S. will soon be a net exporter of oil.
Prices rise to higher highs, it won't be petroleum. What kind of plan was this that has me stalled?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Fidel Geit, who is the Senior Vice President for Oil and Gas Research with Oppenheimer & Company. Mr. Geit has had more than 30 years of experience in oil and gas research and has previously been with Mobil Oil and J.P. Morgan Company in New York. He's one of the most quoted analysts on energy issues and has testified before the United States Senate and the U.S. House of Representatives about oil price speculation. Welcome to Background Briefing, Fidel Geit.
My pleasure.
And it seems like there's a tectonic shift underway in global oil supplies. According to a new report from the International Energy Agency, over the next 5 years, the U.S. will account for a third of new oil supplies globally, and the U.S. will change from the world's leading importer of oil to a net exporter. So this is obviously going to have tremendous repercussions in not just the oil markets, but I think in geopolitics in general.
That's correct. It's really, technology has been a game changer over the last 5 or 6 years, and the speed of change has accelerated over the last 2 years. So we are seeing more and more companies drilling very long lateral wells. Basically, it's the horizontal drilling and the hydraulic fracturing that has been perfected in U.S. shale plays, started with natural gas 10 years ago, and now migrated very successfully to oil shale plays. And that, as a result, last year, U.S. oil production increased by 14%. And again, this trend is likely to continue for many, many years to come.
So what is going to be happening in the future, I take it, with the U.S. expecting to overtake Russia as the world's biggest gas producer by 2015 and to become all but self-sufficient in energy by 2030 or 2035? And, of course, this means that the U.S. will overtake Saudi Arabia to become the world's biggest oil producer, I believe, before even 2020. So this would mean then that it's not the end of the world for OPEC, right? There's the emerging markets with China and the rest of the world that they'll pick up the slack. Is that how it's going to be?
That's correct. Basically, Europe, the demand in Europe is declining. Japan is stagnating, and the U.S. demand is actually on decline, while supply is increasing very rapidly. So, but we have to keep in mind that the U.S. is still the largest energy-consuming country in the world, both oil and natural gas. So, while the U.S. is currently the third largest producer of crude oil, we are by far the largest user of crude oil, so that's why you are the largest importer of crude oil. Because of the domestic supply increase over the last 3 years and the outlook for more to come, our oil imports continue to decline, and this trend will continue, and eventually we'll end up being self-sufficient, and some people think we can even be a net exporter of crude oil in the next 15, 20 years.
So why has this sudden spike in supply, domestic supply, not affected the price? At least looking, every time I go to the gas pump, it fluctuates all the time, but it's not really going down a lot.
Correct. We have to remember a couple of things, is that at the end of the day, what's really going to set the global price is going to be the marginal producer. The marginal producer, or the highest cost producer, happened to be in North America. And that is the Canadian oil sand and the oil shale in the U.S. So for all practical purposes, Saudi Arabia can produce crude at a fraction of the cost that we have in the U.S. Shale oil production costs about $30 to $40 to produce. Saudi Arabia can produce oil for less than $5, maybe $6 per barrel. Russia can produce oil very cheaply, too. So obviously, these countries like and enjoy higher oil price because their economy is dependent on it, and they want this to stay as long as possible. Most of the growth, or all of the growth in oil demand, is coming from the emerging economy, and obviously led by China. But even within OPEC, OPEC oil production and oil consumption is actually growing faster than their production, and therefore their export will likely to decline over time.
Again, I'm speaking with Fidel Guite, who is the Senior Vice President for Oil and Gas Research with Oppenheimer & Company. He has had more than 30 years of experience in oil and gas research and has previously been with Mobil Oil and J.P. Morgan Company. And he's one of the most quoted analysts on energy issues and has testified before the United States Senate and the U.S. House of Representatives about oil price speculation. So let's turn then. I mean, there are two major considerations here. Obviously, oil energy self-sufficiency, which, of course, American presidents have been promising since Richard Nixon, while, in fact, the reverse happened. We became more and more dependent, and our balance of payments became more and more out of whack. So, obviously, in terms of balance of payments, in terms of energy security, this is good news that U.S. and North America are going to become energy self-sufficient and become net exporters within the next couple of decades. On the other hand, aren't there enormous environmental implications here?
Well, absolutely. I mean, there's no question in my mind that that's why I think with the gas revolution that we have, the shale gas that we have in the U.S., we should really pay more attention to converting the U.S. economy instead of being oil-driven economy, if you will. We make it gas-driven. Gas is cheaper, it's cleaner, more abundant. The $64 question is not if, is when, and how we're going to do that. The key, really, or a game changer will be widespread use of natural gas as a transportation fuel. And there are two ways of doing that, either the CNG or compressed natural gas, which basically more city buses are using it from L.A. to New York to elsewhere. And then gas to liquid, which is more expensive. And that is basically create a product like low sulfur diesel, very clean, very efficient, and that is very limited in supply around the world because the plant that produces this product is basically very expensive. But technology most likely will bring the cost down and would bring the yield of the product up. Therefore, it could be really a game changer if we, instead of using gasoline in the U.S. or diesel, we basically use liquefied or actually gas. Well, it's liquid at room temperature, which is which. This is basically what we want to do. It will take time. It will take money. But it eventually will come.
But, Fidel Guite, what I meant about the environment was that the increase of use of natural gas is largely coming from the fracking, which is, of course, underground high water blasting open shale rock at high water pressures underground. And critics of this process point to the high use of water, when water may turn out to be more valuable in the long run, and contamination of aquifers, and the release of methane. So, and this process, of course, has been banned in France and was banned in the UK until they lifted a moratorium just recently. So, and then you've got all the issues over the Canadian tar sands. So this is not, from what I can see, a free ride here with natural gas.
No, nothing really free. First of all, the industry is paying attention to the potential environmental impact of fracking. Number one, they are reducing the use of water by recycling the water. Some of the companies are recycling 90% of the water. And finally, after that, they drill disposable wells that they finally put their water in it. But there are several companies, including Royal Dutch Shell and ExxonMobil, and I'm sure some others, they are working on what we call waterless frack. Basically, instead of using water as a carrier or medium for the proppant to go into the cracked structures, to use inert gas, and that can be easily recycled and will leave really no residues behind. So Exxon, I believe, also is working with some electric charge, if you will, that will create the same impact of fracturing the rock using high-pressure liquid by using an electric charge. So the industry is definitely taking all the necessary steps to, number one, reduce the use of water, save disposal of the water, and then finally eliminating water altogether. And I'm absolutely convinced it's a matter of time before they do that.
But this is obviously a different situation vis-a-vis the Canadian tar sands, because
the tar sands is a completely different issue.
Right.
This is a mining operation. In most cases, there's something called SAGD technology, which is basically injecting superheated steam into the ground at depths of a couple of thousand feet. Or less, and basically melt the tar like bitumen to the surface. People are making obviously a lot of noise about the impact. I have not really seen scientific evidence that would be the case. I visited the Athabasca oil sand project in Western Canada, and it's enormous. It's gigantic. But there are billions of dollars that are being spent. And once the land is reclaimed, because, again, all these tailings, after you extract the bitumen, is returned back. It's put back in the ground, and the land is reclaimed. And, the reclaimed land, when you pass by it, you would not think that anything, happened over the last 15, 20 years.
But the water is the key here, and that is what concerns environmentalists, because you have to use the water, vast amounts of it, to heat it, which costs energy, and
correct.
Then and to make the steam, which separates the sand, the tar from the sand.
Correct.
And that water ends up in these vast lakes, which are polluted. That's the main concern that I understand about the Canadian Tar Sands Project.
Well, again, the disposal, the Canadian are pretty rigorous when it comes to environmental issues. They are probably more proactive than we are. And I am sure if it's an alarming situation, we'll be hearing, volumes about it. So, yes, it is an issue. The industry is definitely working on at least making sure that the water is safely disposed of. But beyond that, we have not seen any evidence from the environmentalists show any degradation, if you will, in these areas.
Well, I've talked to environmentalists who said they've flown over these vast brackish lakes, and they likened it to Mordor out of Lord of the Rings. So, this is something that obviously, I'm sure you're aware that this is a tremendous political issue that most American environmentalists oppose the Keystone XL.
But having said that, if you have rain and melting snow, it will just have water and puddles, and you can see them from a plane. And this is Mother Nature. I mean, basically the water, nothing is added. There is no chemical that the companies are using to extract the bitumen out of the sand. It is basically they are separate. It's a separation. It is not a chemical process. It's basically a unit operation where basically you're separating the sand from the bitumen.
Right, but if you do that, Fidel, surely the clean water, when it washes the sand out of the bitumen, ends up being dirty water with oil residue. I mean, it's logical.
But what I'm saying is, like, when, you know, rain, if you will, when it goes into and mix with the bitumen and mix with the sand, more or less it has the same leaching effect. That this water has to go somewhere and is going to go into the ground, you know. Obviously, the water that is coming out of the oil sand mine, it is going to be more concentrated, if you will, but it is going to be dumped back into the area that has been excavated to take the bitumen out. So. Yes, I realize that, but again, people are saying if we keep doing that for another 10, 20, 30, 40 years, then obviously you'll have an elevated level of whatever bitumen in the water. But again, it's coming back to its origin. It is basically a full cycle. It's coming back to where it started from.
Well, I'm obviously going to have to do a follow-up with the environmentalists on this issue, because they certainly, as you know, there's a tremendous movement to stop the Keystone XL pipeline, and people are very concerned about what the Secretary of State Kerry will rule on that. And if they rule in favor of the Canadian tar sands, and by the way, everything about our conversation is about how the U.S. is becoming a net exporter. Isn't that one of the criticisms of the XL pipeline, is at the end of the day, it will be exporting oil through Texas?
Yeah, but having said that, let us be realistic. We're still importing more than 10 million barrels per day. I mean, it's many, many, many. That is assuming that oil prices will be still at $90 or $100. That is still, you know, saying that, you know, there will be no access to cheaper crude elsewhere in the world, and geopolitics will take a toll on new projects and so forth. So we'll have to walk before we run.
Well, Fidel Guide, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Fidel Guide, who's the Senior Vice President for Oil and Gas Research with Oppenheimer & Company. He has more than 30 years of experience in oil and gas research and has previously been with Mobil Oil and JP Morgan Company, and is one of the most quoted analysts on energy issues, and has testified before the United States Senate and the U.S. House of Representatives about oil price speculation. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time.